Is your child's behavior driving you crazy? Are they defiant, disrespectful, or obnoxious with you?
This is your fault!
No one ever teaches you how to be a parent, and kids don't come with instruction manuals until now. I'm James Lehman, creator of The Total Transformation, the program that helps you fix every behavior problem. Defiance, back-talking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration.
In 1 month after doing this program, I saw huge changes in my son, and even the teacher noticed. I mean, it was great. I just felt like I've got my life back. I can breathe again because I know how to respond to my kids.
I've used the Total Transformation to solve even the worst behavior problems. I guarantee your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back in your home. Call now and get my bonus CD. Turn your child's attitude around in 1 minute or less, free with your order.
Kids are not defective. Part 7. Drapetomania. In the 21st century, we all recognize the institution of slavery for exactly what it was, a vile and inexcusable moral evil. But once upon a time in early colonial America, did you know that it was good? You see, it took uncivilized people and made them civilized by teaching them about peaceful religions like Christianity. The slaves got food, they got a place to sleep, and they even got some tasks to help prevent them from getting bored when they weren't busy eating or sleeping. Unfortunately, for the plantation owners and the apologists who perpetuated these ridiculous stories, they eventually began to lose control of the moral narrative. These stories didn't fly anymore. So what did they do? They didn't give up. They just switched from an argument of morality to an argument of practicality. They no longer claimed that slavery was good or that they were doing God's work. Slavery was now necessary. The entire Southern economy was entirely dependent on this institution, and the United States itself might collapse if slavery were to go away. Unfortunately, again, for the apologists and the planters, the moral arguments were just too strong. They overpowered this newfound pragmatism. And by the middle of the 19th century, it was clear that slavery's days were numbered. Then, in a desperate and despicable and embarrassing attempt to save this crumbling institution, an apologist doctor named Samuel Cartwright stepped forward to explain to people what the real problem with slavery was. The slaves. You see, they had, like, mental problems, Cartwright claimed, specifically what he called drapetomania, a disease that gave them this compulsion to flee captivity. Fortunately, this idea, even 160 years ago, was drowned out in a chorus of laughter. Cartwright faded into obscurity, and slavery ended shortly after. The attempt to pathologize, a natural resistance to an institution that was evil and unnatural, had failed. And those who wanted to subjugate human beings for their own ends, and those who knelt beside them, began to learn a valuable lesson, that they could only fight against the obvious truth and the human desire for freedom for so long before they finally had to retreat, exhausted and embarrassed. From alternet.org, January 28th, 2008, by Dr. Bruce E. Levine, clinical psychologist. How teenage rebellion has become a mental illness. Big Pharma has some new customers. Not complying with authority is now, in many cases, labeled a disease. For a generation now, disruptive young Americans who rebel against authority figures have been increasingly diagnosed with mental illnesses and medicated with psychiatric or psychotropic drugs. Disruptive young people who are medicated with Ritalin, Adderall, and other amphetamines routinely report that these drugs make them, quote, care less about their boredom, resentments, and other negative emotions, thus making them more compliant and manageable. And so-called atypical antipsychotics, such as Risperdal and Zyprexa, powerful tranquilizing drugs, are increasingly prescribed to disruptive young Americans, even though in most cases they are not displaying any psychotic symptoms. Many talk show hosts think I'm kidding when I mention oppositional defiant disorder, ODD. After I assure them that ODD is in fact an official mental illness, an increasingly popular diagnosis for children and teenagers, they often guess that ODD is simply a new term for juvenile delinquency. But that is not the case. Young people diagnosed with ODD, by definition, are doing nothing illegal. Illegal behaviors are a symptom of another mental illness called conduct disorder. In 1980, the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, created oppositional defiant disorder, defining it as, quote, a pattern of negativistic, hostile, and defiant behavior, unquote. The official symptoms of ODD include often actively defies or refuses to comply with adult requests or rules, and often argues with adults. While ODD-diagnosed young people are obnoxious with adults they don't respect, these kids can be a delight with adults they do respect, yet many of them are medicated with psychotropic drugs. An even more common reaction to oppressive authorities than overt defiance is some type of passive defiance. John Holt, the late school critic, described passive-aggressive strategies employed by prisoners in concentration camps and slaves on plantations, as well as some children in classrooms. Holt pointed out that subjects may attempt to appease their rulers while still satisfying some part of their own desire for dignity by, quote, putting on a mask and acting much more stupid and incompetent than they really are, by denying their rulers the full use of their intelligence and ability, by declaring their minds and spirits free of their enslaved bodies, unquote. Holt observed that by going stupid in a classroom, children frustrate authorities through withdrawing the most intelligent and creative parts of their minds from the scene, thus achieving some sense of potency. Going stupid, or passive aggression, is one of many non-disease explanations for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Studies show that virtually all ADHD-diagnosed children will pay attention to activities that they enjoy or that they have chosen. In other words, when ADHD-labeled kids are having a good time and in control, the disease goes away. There are other passive rebellions against authority that have been medicalized by mental health authorities. I have talked to many people who earlier in their lives had been diagnosed with substance abuse, depression, and even schizophrenia, but believe that their symptoms had, in fact, been a kind of resistance to the demands of an oppressive environment. Some of these people now call themselves psychiatric survivors. While there are several reasons for a behavioral disruptiveness and emotional difficulties, rebellion against an oppressive environment is one common reason that is routinely not even considered by many mental health professionals. Why? It is my experience that many mental health professionals are unaware of how extremely obedient they are to authorities. Acceptance into medical school and graduate school and achieving a PhD or MD means jumping through many meaningless hoops, all of which require much behavioral, attentional, and emotional compliance to authorities, even disrespected ones. When compliant MDs and PhDs begin seeing non-compliant patients, many of these doctors become anxious, sometimes even ashamed of their own excessive compliance. And this anxiety and shame can be fuel for diseasing normal human reactions. Two ways of subduing defiance are to criminalize it and to pathologize it. And U.S. history is replete with examples of both. In the same era that John Adams' Sedition Act criminalized criticism of U.S. governmental policy, Dr. Benjamin Rush, the father of American psychiatry, his image adorns the APA seal, pathologized anti-authoritarianism. Rush diagnosed those rebelling against a centralized federal authority as having an, quote, excess of passion for liberty, unquote, that, quote, constituted a form of insanity, unquote. He labeled this illness anarchia. Throughout American history, both direct and indirect resistance to authority has been diseased. In an 1851 article in the New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal, Louisiana physician Samuel Cartwright reported his discovery of drapetomania, the disease that caused slaves to flee captivity. Cartwright also reported his discovery of dysthesia aethiopis, a disease that caused slaves to pay insufficient attention to the master's needs. Early versions of ODD and ADHD. In Russia's lifetime, few Americans took anarchia seriously, nor was drapetomania, or dysthesia aethiopis, taken seriously in Cartwright's lifetime. But these were eras before the diseasing of defiance had a powerful financial ally in Big Pharma. In every generation, there will be authoritarians. There will also be the bohemian bourgeois, who may enjoy anti-authoritarian books, music, and movies, but don't act on them. And there will be the genuine anti-authoritarians, who are so pained by exploitive hierarchies that they take action. Only occasionally in American history do these genuine anti-authoritarians actually take effective, direct action that inspires others to successfully revolt. But every once in a while, a Tom Paine comes along. So authoritarians take no chances, and the state corporate partnership criminalizes anti-authoritarianism, pathologizes it, markets drugs to cure it, and financially intimidates those who might buck the system. It would certainly be a dream of Big Pharma and those who favor an authoritarian society if every would-be Tom Paine or Crazy Horse, Tecumseh, Emma Goldman, or Malcolm X were diagnosed as a youngster with mental illness and quieted with a lifelong regimen of chill pills. The question is, has this dream become a reality? Dr. Bruce Levine will join me in a moment to discuss this article.
In preschool, another teacher suggested medication.
Her opinion was that there was a chemical situation going on with this child that maybe medication could help. But we thought, a four-year-old? I mean, what, you know, why put him on pharmaceuticals at age four?
Oh, boy.
He's a little kid.
For a year, the Solomons resisted medicating Jacob, but teachers persisted. Finally, Jacob's parents took him to a doctor. Jacob was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and prescribed Ritalin. The Ritalin helped with the hyperactivity, but it made him anxious.
And so then we'd end up giving him a second medication to deal with the anxiety. And then the second medication would cause something else, some compulsive behavior or a tic. And then they'd say, okay, give him a third thing.
My guest today is Dr. Bruce Levine. He is a clinical psychologist and the author of Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy. And he is also the author of an article that I found on alternet.org that caught my attention and interest, How Teenage Rebellion Has Become a Mental Illness. Dr. Levine, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine here. Good to be on your show.
Thank you very much for joining me. And I wanted to just get a little bit of a background as far as what led up to this article, as far as your research or your discovery that rebellion among teenagers, this generation of teenagers, and maybe my generation as well, I'm 33, this is really something that has developed in the last 30 years and has accelerated with, you know, increasing speed in the last 15 years. How did you start to discover this and become concerned about this?
Well, historically, if you take a look at the history of psychiatry and diagnoses, they've routinely, as I've mentioned in that article, been diagnosing all kinds of noncompliance. And a lot of the world really didn't take it very seriously. So when that, you know, Dr. Cartwright in 1851 tries to diagnose slaves who are running away from their plantation as having some mental illness, I mean, you know, from his point of view, I mean, well, why else would they run away? I mean, you know, how could they want to run away from this wonderful place called a slave plantation? Well, at that time, certainly everybody in the North thought the guy was out of his mind. If you would ask Thoreau, he thought he was crazy. And maybe there would even be people in the South who thought that this was quite silly. The real problem today is that a lot of these kind of silly, goofy folks who are doing the same thing, with a lot of Dr. Cartwrights walking around and pathologizing noncompliance and rebellion, they are taken seriously. And we know that for sure because of 1980, the most obvious situation there is that the American Psychiatric Association, their Bible of mental illnesses, comes up with this diagnosis called oppositional defiant disorder, which is very similar, really, to this trypanomania. I mean, this oppositional defiant disorder is about you know, kids, the official symptoms, not wanting to comply with adults, arguing with adults, just basically it's a disobedience thing. And initially, that's about when that came out, that 1980 DSM, and for folks who are outside of this shrink business that I'm in, is they started with the first DSM was 1952, and it only had a few, it was a very thin book with very few diagnoses, and by the time they got up to now this DSM-4, it is this huge, thick manual with close to 400 diagnoses. Well, 1980 was an interesting year when they really started introducing in the DSM, the third version, a lot of these kiddie diagnoses that at the time people who were mental health professionals, there were many even rebellious mental health professionals, more so back then, who would go, this is silly, this is not a mental illness, this is just kids not behaving. But, you know, it was 1980, and they started to come up with these diagnoses called oppositional defiant disorder. And originally people didn't hear about them. They were very arcane, unpopular. And then they went to using just simplistic behavior modification for these things, which started to get me concerned. But nowadays, I mean, we have, you know, lots of research showing that they're using medication on these noncompliant kids, and not just your lightweight medication, your heavy-duty tranquilizer. So, you know, for me this is real embarrassing to be a mental health professional for this kind of thing to be going on. Mm.
And just to jump back to Cartwright in the 1850s for a minute, the disease that he came up with to describe this irrational compulsion that slaves had to run away, what was the name again? I don't want to butcher the pronunciation.
Drapetomania. So drapeto meaning slaves, right? And mania being mania, right?
Yep.
And so he came up with this term drapetomania. He also had another one, which was dysesthesia ethiopis. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that one correctly, but that was basically slaves who didn't pay sufficient attention to the master's requests, which is almost exactly like ADD, if you take a look at the symptoms of this other one. So basically, drapetomania is a modern oppositional defiant disorder, and this other one is really very close to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But again, like I said, back in those days, most people with any common sense just laughed at this guy. They didn't take this seriously.
Right, when it didn't have the backing of, obviously, the field of psychology has developed tremendously since then. I'm not even sure that in 1850 it was considered a legitimate field of study. So now when you have all this backing of legitimacy behind it, people take these very similar things, even though you're describing all the way back in the last days of slavery, basically these templates for the modern versions like ODD and ADHD or ADD. Yeah, people were right not to take it seriously back then, and it makes me wonder. Cartwright was clearly an apologist for slavery, but I wonder, and I'm speculating here a little bit, did he see this as like a last-ditch effort to save this institution that was once thought of as good, and then when thought in the colonies and then in the United States evolved beyond the point where, like, we can't even pretend that this thing is good anymore, like we're taking care of these people, or this is some kind of benevolent action to, you know, capture people or hold people in captivity generation after generation. I wonder, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, even though on my part it's speculation, did Cartwright see this as a last-ditch effort to save that once the argument failed for it?
Well, what I would my speculation is, watching doctors in modern times, is that they're always looking to kind of kiss up to authority. I mean, you have in some ways the most authoritarian population out there, with exceptions that, you know, there are some major exceptions, but they really stand out. Those doctors, and in fact those teachers, psychologists, psychiatrists, teachers, who are willing to assert themselves with authority, many of them don't go in the profession, or they get kicked out, or they don't last very long. There's very few of those kind of rebellious types who are in this, and so a lot of these folks are people who, either for prestige or for money, want to make those in authority feel good. So, for example, I mean, for Cartwright, I mean, he would love to have these plantation owners feeling that what they're doing is a neat thing, and there can't be possibly anything wrong with it. So, for example, if some of these slaves are running away, it's not because it's this cruel, dehumanizing system, and they're doing something that just takes a lot of courage and is very human, but that they must be mentally ill. And, you know, a similar thing that I also mentioned in that article was a person who was actually a lot more well-known, one of the most prestigious doctors in America at the time of the American Revolution, a guy named Dr. Benjamin Rush, who actually signed the one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, the American Psychiatric Association. They consider him the father of psychiatry. His image is on the APA, American Psychiatric Association, seal. Well, one of the interesting things that he did to kind of ingratiate himself with authority was that right after the revolution, you know, they didn't know how it was going to go. You had the two folks, there was the two sides, right, one who wanted more freedom and more liberty, and the other side, you know, Alexander Hamilton and the Federals, who wanted more centralized control. And so there were rebellions, major rebellions, going on post-revolution for folks like the Shays Rebellion and all those kinds of things, and folks who know anything about American history. And so Rush comes along, and he comes up with his own diagnosis for those folks who are rebelling, and he calls it anarchia, like anarchy. Anarchia is a disease, an illness, for people who are have what he calls, quotes, an excessive passion for liberty. How's that? That's a disease, an excessive passion for liberty. You get a mental illness. Well, why did he do that? I mean, he was, you know, and he said this constituted a form of insanity, again, because there were the folks, the American elite at the time, who were really worried about this thing getting out of hand. They were worried about real democracy taking over. I mean, it's one thing, you know, they wanted to kind of, you know, grab some power away from the British and have some control, but heck, you know, they were very careful in that Constitution to not take seriously what they talked about in the Declaration of Independence, and here there were some Americans who were taking that seriously. So what do you do? Well, you know, you have the Sedition Acts. John Adams, the Federalist, comes with Alien and Sedition Acts, and he tries to, you know, criminalize anti-authoritarianism, and then you have this goofy Dr. Benjamin Rush, who's the hero of the American Psychiatric Association today, comes up with a mental illness called anarchia. Again, at that era, I'm sure, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson and all these other folks were just laughing. I mean, nobody took that seriously. The difference today, the big difference, is drug companies, okay? Big pharma. We got this huge multi-billion dollar backing now, so now any kind of goofy disease psychiatrists come up with, what goes along with that are $1 billion blockbuster drugs. And so that's how come things get taken seriously nowadays, a big reason anyways.
Yeah, and like you mentioned in the article, I believe that the field of psychology is very much a field of compliance, people wanting to please the authorities. But also, you know, to go through that process of achieving a PhD in psychology, there is a lot of flaming hoops that you have to jump through. And by the time somebody is in the position of, you know, a school psychologist, they are well trained in compliance. And when these things come down from the top, there probably aren't too many questions about the validity of, you know, whether something like ADHD or ADD or ODD constitutes an actual disease, something physiological. It was always explained to us as a, you know, chemical imbalances and these very sort of abstruse descriptions. But even in the DSM, things like oppositional defiant disorder and ADHD, if you look at the criteria that's used for diagnosis, they are incredibly nebulous. And as I've looked at them in the past, I've said, well, how many kids, as they're diagnosing kids in fourth and fifth grade with something like ADD or ADHD today, how many kids at that age are not meeting the criteria to be diagnosed with this disease.
Right. Well, there's two basic issues in science and that why all these diagnoses are not scientific. One is the issue of validity, which in common sense means is this thing meaningful at all? Is it meaningful to call a young child or a teenager who is refusing to comply with authority, arguing with adults and being annoyed? Is it meaningful? Is it valid to call that a disease? But then there's a second issue. Even if you are, I don't know how you could, you know, come to the conclusion that that is valid, but let's say you do. There is the issue of reliability, which means do we have research showing that this is like diabetes or this is like cancer? Is this something that people can give somebody a test or have lab results and that if they show it to 10 different or even 5 different mental health professionals, they'll come up with the same diagnosis? Well, no, because these are all paper and pencil questionnaires. I've looked at many, many kids who've been labeled as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There's no blood test. There's no EEG. There's no brain scan. It's all done by these inventories that are usually given out to teachers or parents. And routinely, I see this all the time, if a teacher really likes a kid, somehow the kid doesn't get labeled as ADHD. Somehow the teacher does not check off all the items that has to do with the kids not paying attention. And then I could ask a kid, I said, I bet you I know which teachers you don't like, who don't like you. And sure enough, I always get it right, because those are the teachers who are labeling the kid as being, you know, not paying attention, being bored, being impulsive. So much of these things are situation, personal, specific. And, you know, we know that one of the most comical things about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there's many, many studies that show when these kids are in situations that's novel, that they're interested in, or even when they're paid, their ADHD goes away. And so when I throw that at kind of mainstream establishment psychology, they say, well, you know, basically, they don't say it exactly in these terms, but what they say is, like, it's a mental illness, it's a mental disorder if somebody can't pay attention in situations that they really don't want to be in. And I'm going, boy, if that's a mental illness, our whole society is in deep trouble.
And when things are characterized as a disease, you know, I always would think about that as there would be some kind of pathology or some kind of, at the very least, some kind of compulsion to behave that certain way, and it wouldn't be incredibly situational. But my experience, you know, I worked with kids who were labeled oppositional defiant throughout the first several years of my educational career, going back about 10 years. And boy, I got to tell you, same thing with ADHD. They seem to be able to control the ODD, depending on who they were interacting with as far as adults were concerned, and they were able to control their ADD based on the activities that they were involved in. So it makes me kind of wonder, these things were incredibly situational, and it seems like the very process of keeping children in captivity, or the infantilization of teenagers, where the natural inclination of somebody that age is to become an adult, that all of these problems have risen up out of that mistreatment of young people.
Right. I mean, school is definitely a reason. It is the major reason why kids get labeled, because many of these kids, outside of school situations, they're having no problems. And sadly, not only is there nothing essentially wrong with a lot of these ODD and ADD kids, for me, they're the hope of society in a lot of ways. I mean, these are the kind of kids who have some kind of spirit, who have some kind of ability to say, hey, look, if I'm not interested in something, if I don't care about something, if I don't respect somebody who's teaching this stuff, I am not going to comply. I'm not going to conform. I think that's a good thing. And when I've always worked with these folks, I don't want to ever take that out of them. I mean, you know, what you want to try to do is help them be in situations where that's respected, or if they can't be in those kind of situations, it's impossible. So parents don't have any money to put them in an environmental setting where they can be that way. Is you kind of help them navigate these environments, but you don't. And this is what this is, again, the embarrassment of my mental health profession here is that you don't invalidate something that's very, you know, very, you know, very impressive about them and something to be respected. And, you know, if you take a look at many, many famous people and you look at their childhood, they were often, you know, they hated school and they would have been labeled ODD or ADHD. If you take a look at, for example, Albert Einstein, I mean, he didn't bother talking to him. What was he, when he was a kid in elementary school, the guy was thinking about light. I mean, that's what he was thinking about. What was it made of? And so these, you know, these guys, these teachers were teaching garbage and crap that he couldn't care less about. So he didn't speak. He stared out the window. And for sure, if you take a look at a biography of Albert Einstein, he would have been labeled with ADHD. And there's many other of these famous or rebellious characters that we know in history who we respect who would have been labeled with ODD.
And Einstein's story is really quite miraculous, too, when you think about where he was attending school. I believe in Germany, where they had inherited the Prussian education system. Now, of course, we have that system in America as well, courtesy of Horace Mann. And it was never really about, you know, sort of sparking up the interest or even maintaining the natural gifts that we all have as children, the curiosity, the individuality. It was very much about crushing it into compliance and, you know, worship for the state and worship for the leaders. So, yeah, I think Einstein's story is quite amazing. But that's not, we shouldn't take credit away from all the people in this country who are in a very similar education system, even though we're a few more generations removed from its inception in the Prussian kingdom. But, yeah, it's really quite miraculous that people can pull out of that and achieve, you know, their own goals or follow what they decide is their own purpose. It's really great.
Right. You can't kill the human heart here in terms of, you know, their desire to kind of resist and rebel against things that make no sense. I mean, the scary thing about modern days here, especially in the last 20, 30 years, is the use of these medications. Because routinely, historically, when these attempts were made to crush people, you know, they didn't do any kind of biochemical or physiological kind of damage. I mean, they might have had horrible, miserable time in school. You know, they might have gotten whacked around by parents and teachers and principals and all that kind of stuff. But it was easier to live to fight another day. When you've got folks labeled, you know, with these diseases, you know, a couple of things happen to them. First of all is that for many of these folks, they now internalize these labels. Other people start viewing them that way. They start viewing themselves as having an illness. And also, like I said, the problem of medication. And we're going to see scarier and scarier things happening off of these kids who are being medicated. We already know, for example, this huge escalation of pediatric bipolar disorder, which is, you know, I mean, back when I first started out, before this, you know, they were drugging kids left and right, you know, 25 years ago, you'd never see little kids labeled with bipolar disorder. I mean, it would be, just be, you know, unheard of. Now, you know, you see it for two reasons. One is, again, the drug companies have, you know, decided that kids who are very moody and, you know, maybe have this thing called bipolar as opposed to being kids, but also there are more and more kids acting bizarrely because of these drugs themselves. We know a certain percentage of kids who take these ADHD drugs, which are amphetamines, Adderall, and all these drugs are amphetamine drugs, or these Prozac, Paxil, SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. A significant percentage of these kids will move into manic reactions. So there you go. You've taken a kid with nothing essentially ill about them. You've labeled them. You started to drug them for that, and now you've created even more serious problems. Well, you know, who can, you know, the people who are running the show, the drug companies, the big pharma, who basically run psychiatry nowadays, you know, they love it. I mean, they're creating, they're creating a business for life, a customer for life for themselves.
There is certainly a very unholy nexus between the state itself and the pharmaceutical industry, as is the case with any sort of cartelized industry. And pharmaceuticals is certainly that. Now we look at what's going on in the public schools. The school that I worked at was private. It was a residential school, but the kids were all in state custody. And I have to tell you, I was the medication person at this school. I hate to look back at not only what I was involved in, you know, 7-8 years ago, but also I kind of shudder at my own ignorance about what was going on. Because when the taxpayers were basically footing the bill for these kids' living expenses, it was amazing how heavily medicated they were. And you're right that, that all of these drugs, like if you catch a drug commercial halfway through, you know, you'd say, wow, that drug could cure a lot of things. And you're like, oh, no, wait, those are the things that it can do to you, because they have to list like 25, 30 side effects. Now, I gave kids Ritalin, obviously, Adderall, obviously, Risperdal, Zyprexa, Buspar, lithium, Seroquel. I remember giving one boy who weighed less than 100 pounds 35 pills in one day for wow. No noticeable changes in his behavior. So it did seem like when kids were in state custody, not only were they heavily, heavily medicated, but it would become this cocktail balancing act where as the side effects of one of the drugs to deal with one of the issues would start to present themselves, new drugs would be brought in to deal with the side effects until, you know, they had these weekly med boxes that weighed 5 or 6 pounds. And it was really, you know, when I think back about it, I kind of cringe that I was involved in something like that. And this was even, you know, this was almost a decade ago. And I know that it's only accelerated and gotten worse since then. So, I mean, it is certainly a crisis for sure.
Right. And it's worse. I think what it's worse for poor kids, I just did a piece for Canapuch a little back. And it's worse for poor kids. They get more Medicaid. So, you know, for if they're getting labeled with just these behavioral problems, we have statistics that is most twice as likely they're going to be on the heavy duty antipsychotic tranquilizers, like you mentioned, Risperdal and Zyprexa. And why is that? Well, because of Medicaid. I mean, and we know the vast majority of kids who are taking those kinds of drugs, you know, Medicaid reimburses it, and they're basically just total. You're if you want to completely control a kid and you want to completely zombify them, you're going to use the heaviest tranquilizing drugs there are, and you're going to get reimbursed for it, you know, by the state. And so the drug companies, you know, all the control freak and the greedy folks win. You know, psychiatrists get to feel like they've controlled it. The teacher, if the teacher's a control freak, the kid's going to be totally compliant on these tranquilizers. The drug companies, you know, they win easy Medicaid money. And so everybody wins, quotes, except for the poor kid. And it's pretty sad. I think, you know, get back to a point that you made earlier, which I want to kind of get back to, is why is it, you know, these psychologists, psychiatrists, and to some extent teachers, you know, they go along with this. And I think from my experience, these are the folks who have been the most compliant their whole life. I mean, people who are more non-compliant and more anti-authoritarian, as a rule, don't go into teaching or psychology, psychiatry. Right. Or if they do go into it, they're more likely to quit because they get what's going on. They see that this stuff is less than teaching is not so much about education. It's about socialization, and they see what's going on in the mental health professions as well. So they quit, or in some places they get kicked out. And so you have what's left in these populations are folks who don't question authority. Either they don't question to themselves and they really buy into all of this silliness, or they don't have enough guts and enough courage. And I've been around a lot of psychologists who they will come, you know, to me and say, "Wow, I'm really glad with what you're saying," but they're not saying it themselves. So it's not a group with a lot of courage. And so that's, you know, kids just basically get sold out.
And of course they can tell themselves a story as well. They can tell themselves a story to kind of push down the uncomfortable emotions as they start to surface, or as they start, they just become too powerful to ignore. They can, I believe, from my experience with, especially with teachers, they can start a mantra. And I think this happens in society, this happens in culture, all the time. When people start to have to deal with the uncomfortable emotions, that come with recognizing the truth, they will, you know, the cognitive dissonance kicks in, and they will start to, at the very least, rationalize what is happening.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I see that, and I just recently did a piece about the military using these psychologists and psychiatrists to get folks to comply there, too. And so you've got some of the people in the military get a little uncomfortable with the idea of we've got, like, now one out of every six of our military personnel on psychiatric drugs to basically be in, you know, situations where at some level they know it really is unnecessary for us to be there. And so they're doing multiple tours, and there's just a lot of insanity going on, more so than usual in the American military. And at some level, a lot of these guys, officers, even feel that. But what do they do with their cognitive dissonance? Well, you know, they say, like, well, a doctor prescribed it. It must be good. Right. The doctor prescribed it, so it must be right. And then the doctors go, like, well, the FDA, you know, the FDA certified this, the Food and Drug Administration, they certified it, so it must be right. So everybody has some kind of authority that they can use to quell their, as you use the term, cognitive dissonance.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure that the people who benefit the most from all of this in the various areas that we're talking about are often saying, thank God for school. You know, thank goodness there was some place where these people could learn this kind of just self-sacrificing obedience and compliance and, you know, abandon their curiosity, abandon their creative or critical thinking about all of these things and just let us have our way. I'm sure there's a lot of people saying stuff like that in a lot of different places and a lot of different industries. But, you know, there was one more thing that I wanted to touch on, kind of going back to where we were at the beginning, where we're talking about this sad and desperate attempt by Cartwright to come up with this final explanation for this incredibly just vile and immoral and unnatural institution of slavery. The truth is that the concept of adolescence itself is relatively new. It's something that was invented. And as I was describing and reflecting my own experience in this residential school, we were pulling a lot of kids out of the inner city, Baltimore and Washington DC. And these were poverty-stricken, you know, abusive households. And they were all kind of, grouped together into this residential school in Vermont. Now, if somebody came and did a study on adolescence in this place, obviously that is far too narrow a cross-section to get anything useful as far as conclusions are concerned. But I'm reminded of a guy named G. Stanley Hall, who in 1904 wrote a book introducing the concept of adolescence as he used this phrase, it was a time in life characterized by storm and stress. But Hall himself was a professor at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and all of his subjects were inner-city poor and immigrants. And the entire concept of adolescence was basically introduced to our society going forward from that point by this guy Hall, with this very, very narrow cross-section and a lot of junk science. It's amazing how destructive that can become when it's taken seriously.
Right. I mean, if you take a look at a lot of indigenous populations, and there are many accounts from American indigenous cultures to Australia to Polynesia, and you see that when folks are in this teenage years, these 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, prior to their subjugation by kind of Western civilization, when they were just living the way they've always lived, there is not anything like the kind of teenagers that happen here in this kind of institutionalized, you know, crushing, attempt to crush young men and young women who in many of these other societies, you know, would have been you know, close to being full members of the tribe, and, you know, and parents, and what happens here is you've got folks who are biologically, in many ways, close to their young men and young women who are being infantilized, who are being humiliated, who are being crushed, and of course they rebel, of course they resist. It just feels completely unnatural, and you know, you have a society, these other societies, a lot of these indigenous cultures, where folks wanted desperately remotely to be able to do what the adults did, because it was fun. I mean, it was fun to go hunting. It was fun to go out there and, you know, whatever the tribe was doing, ripping off horses from the tribe next door, whatever the heck they were doing, they wanted to be that way. So they were looking for that kind of respect and admiration from elders so that they could do what those guys were doing in our culture, in our society. I mean, what we're doing here is trying to basically take folks in that age group and make sure we crush them and humiliate them and get them to comply and get them to conform. And we do it through our schools. And if the ones who are not exactly, we're not exactly crushing effectively, well, there's always the shrinks. There's always the psychologists and psychiatrists. And then for the unsuccessful there when they're 18 or 19, we've got three other institutions to crush them. We've got jails, you know, which America right now is the leading jailer of the world, 2.3 million incarcerated. We've got our military. We've got the biggest military in the world to kind of crush some of the more defiant teenagers there. And there's always college and universities. we'll crush them if I put them in debt. I mean, that's the biggest thing that's going on now in the last 20 years is, like, that's a great way to crush kids. Tell them that they're nothing. They're garbage if they don't go to college and they don't go to universities, you know. And then when we get them there, we saddle them with $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $80,000 of debt, and that'll crush them that way. So we got them coming and going.
Yeah, I hate to laugh because it's so true, but it all starts. I mean, whether it's the, you know, jail or the military or college, I guess the most socially acceptable of those three options, adolescence is very much this waiting line. You know, where the natural inclination is to move forward, that people have reached a point where they can see what the adult world looks like, and they're told, no, stop, wait, and they're put in this holding pattern where, yes, they're very much infantilized. It's like pushing against their natural trajectory to, you know, become productive members of society, to become their own individuals. And, you know, having worked with people in that age group for 10 years, you can see the frustration, and you can really see even the holes it drills, where people want to find themselves. You know, I really believe that's we know so much more when we're younger about that, and then it's kind of lost. And it's so much a period of carrots and sticks and infantilization that it's very, very hard. It's very, very hard to recover from that, whether it's happening at home or it's happening at school or it's happening through the field of psychology. It is happening, and it is really catastrophic.
I agree. I mean, and what's happening to us is what's happened to a lot of other kind of oppressed societies. So you might remember back when, 20, 30 years ago, where Americans were reading about Paulo Freire and the psychology of the oppressed, or but what's happening in a lot of these other places where the population grows up and feels completely fatalistic, they develop what Bob Marley would call the slave mentality. That kind of thing is that once, you know, happened much more so in a lot of third world societies here. Is becoming more and more routine in American society. So you've got a population now that pretty much puts up with anything. You would be hard pressed to. I mean, you throw wars at them that nobody even understands or nobody believes in. You have, you know, bailouts that of Wall Street that nobody, you know, nobody believes in. And you can go through a whole list of things that either the clear majority in the polls or a huge minority completely, you know, disagrees with, but pretty much there's very little resistance to that. There's very little rebellion against that. And a lot of that goes on. School could take its share of credit. My business, the mental health profession, could take its share of credit. And there are several other aspects of our society that have just completely sort of zombified and mentally enslaved people.
So what would you like to see as a course of action to correct this? I mean, I always say that it really needs to start on the individual level, first with the realization of what is happening, and then kind of, you know, getting honest about what the effects were, and then making a plan. But from your experience, what would you like to see as a, you know, a corrective course of action?
Well, you know, I think one of the positive things are there's many aspects of society that it's very difficult to do anything about. But when you take a look at the three major socializing forces for young people, what do they do with their day? You know, school, most of what goes on for their day, school, television, that's 4 or 5 hours a day, and for the ones who are a little bit rebellious, either passively or actively, they send them to the shrinks. Well, you know, those are three areas in our society that parents can actually do something about. They can actually rebel against that without going to jail. There's alternative schooling, there's homeschooling, and, you know, television, we haven't really touched on that, but that is also a major zombifier of these kids, okay? A major zombifier, not just through the content, through just the act of passively watching that thing. And so when you think about it, if you want to, if your parents out there who care enough about your kids to actually have citizens who could participate in a real democracy, or if you are a young person yourself, is that the good news is it's not illegal yet to refuse to go to standard schools. It's not illegal yet to refuse to watch television. It's not illegal yet. Well, in some cases, fathers, people get in trouble if they don't put their kids on drugs. But for the most part, it's not illegal. So there's some things that you can do. And once you do anything, okay, that gives you a little bit of strength, once you do anything where you refuse to comply and you do what you really believe in and what you really respect, that's how you rehabilitate yourself. I mean, the key ways to start rehabilitating yourself is being honest with yourself. You know, what you don't like, exactly what you're doing. And that takes some self-respect to do that. Say, hey, I participated in a humiliating, dehumanizing system for a while. I'm not proud of that, but I'm going to have enough guts and courage to be honest with myself. That's what you were doing when you're talking about being in these residential schools. And all of us who are teachers, psychologists, psychiatrists have been in these situations, placements or whatever. I mean, I talked to a few rebellious psychiatrists in America, and I think I know them all, and it's humiliating for them if they've ever participated in electroshock, you know, or something really horrific and humiliating like that. And so the first thing is that, to be honest with yourself and to forgive yourself and say, hey, okay, you know, I'm only human, you know, and I didn't know what was going on, or at that time I didn't have enough wherewithal to resist, and that's important. And it's also really important to kind of keep a sense of humor. That's what sort of kept me alive a lot in graduate school, as I had to deal with all this kind of crap and silliness, and we could do a whole show on all the nonsense that I was taught there, from not just the psychiatric diagnoses, but the IQ testing and Rorschach ink blocks, all this totally goofy stuff. And the one way to survive there is again the same way slaves survived in on plantations, or Jews survived in concentration camps. It's through humor, sometimes very dark humor. And those are some of the ways that you kind of keep your soul till you get an opportunity to really escape and heal.
Today, many people are starting to wake up to the idea that seizing control of another person's mind is a moral evil. They are starting to wake up to the idea that forcing children into 12 years of indoctrination, while the indoctrinators remain entirely unaccountable to the people they supposedly serve, is a moral evil. They're starting to wake up to the idea that an organization or institution entirely funded through the use of force and threats is a moral evil, because all of that is obvious. But once upon a time, did you know that all of this was considered good? Now, of course, when public education was first instituted in the United States, it was met with cries of panic from many people. They were worried about children being forced into this mold of conformity. But then people like John Dewey came along to calm their nerves and explain, this is virtuous. You see, the schools had undertaken the noble task of making children good, and more importantly, making these children into good citizens. As society became more enlightened, this ruse that had been so beneficial to the state, to the central planners, and their allies began to be exposed. By the 1970s, there was little debate left over whether public education was good or bad. The only debate that anyone really seemed to be having was, why was it failing so miserably? The defenders and the beneficiaries of the public education system in America could have given up. They could have admitted, you're right, this is not about educating people at all. But they didn't. They just switched from an argument of morality to an argument of practicality. Now, politicians and teachers and union officials had a new story. They said, how will children be prepared for adulthood, for citizenship? How will the poor be educated? Assuming that what is going on now in the inner cities even resembles education. It was around this time in the 1970s, when groups of psychologists, loyal to the power structure as it was and eager to please, set out on a desperate and despicable and embarrassing attempt to try and save face for the government education system by explaining what the real problem was. The kids. You see, they had, like, mental problems, specifically what they called oppositional defiant disorder and ADHD. It wasn't anything to do with the school. It wasn't the teacher's fault. It wasn't the system's fault that these kids couldn't sit still under fluorescent lights 7 hours a day and listen to somebody drone on about something that they didn't care about. And if they dared to question what was going on, if they dared to stand up and say, I don't get why I have to do this, they would be labeled as defective and then drugged into passive compliance. My friends, this practice has a sad desperation written all over it. And I sincerely hope that I live to see the day in a more enlightened world when we can look back at this attempt to pathologize the natural reaction to the unnatural treatment of human beings. And we can say, it failed. Take care.